Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most important and to the fastest growing segment of society. To those who know that the world's religious, which would be a combination of religious and political, media, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, that they cannot be fixed, and therefore trying to vote different people in to these human institutions is a complete and utter waste of our time. Our mission, therefore, is to look behind the headlines, to know who is working against our interests, to understand why they're doing so. Because exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes isn't hateful. It is the most compassionate thing we can do. In our concluding hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, which means teaching, not law, because its covenant provides the only reliable answer for you and your family. Anytime over the next 3 hours, you're encouraged to participate in this discussion. Our toll-free number is 877-300-7645. I watched an editorial last night. It was presented as news, but it was really an editorial on the 60 Minutes. It was in such contrast to what I was witnessing by watching the Olympic Games. The timing of it, the tone of it, really stood out as irritating to me. The story on 60 Minute is that a fellow decided that once the Soviet Union broke up and the new government was selling off nationalized interest to business interests, to try to take the economy from communist to capitalist, or to free enterprise would be a more correct term, that fortunes were made, and that there is a claim by one of those who increased the value of his investments by 35 times in a matter of a handful of years or less, that the Russian government said he did not pay appropriate amount of taxes on his gains. He claims to have increased the value of his portfolio, of his investment, by 35 times. But he claims that that he was Mr. Straightforth and honorable. And that the Russians, and he has this goonish picture of a Russian police officer who got the Russian version of the IRS to seize his companies and use that seizure to pay a tax refund to those very same companies. A very odd claim. Well, this fellow, according to CBS's 60 Minutes, hired an attorney who decided that, you know, what the smart thing to do is in a police state, that I'm going to go after the police and see how that works out for me. And so he assembled some evidence and was going to accuse the official for seizing his friend's company inappropriately. And he ended up in prison, and he was in prison for a year, where there is every evidence that he was treated very poorly. Now, the lawyer ended up dead. No one really knows how he died, but he definitely ended up dead. And so this editorial from 60 Minutes tried to paint Putin as the orchestrator of the murder. Now, before I speak of the contrast, what I want to say is that it's quite possible. Now, this individual, whether or not he's a credible individual that was speaking on behalf of 60 Minutes, he showed no evidence that at any time that would cause you to agree with him. But the realization is likely that Russia is in the same place that the leaders of the United States. Both countries have created spy agencies that are pervasive, and both have established police states. And as a result, you either go along, you either support and don't interfere with the beast that you have created, or you'll become a victim of the very mechanism that both of these countries have created. In the United States, for example, when it was found out that the NSA was grotesquely in violation of the U.S. Constitution, when the senior National Intelligence Officer, James Clapper, was found to have perjured himself before Congress in this regard, almost all congressmen and senators, almost all administration officials rallied around the NSA as opposed to the Constitution. Reminds me of what happened when it became obvious that J. Edgar Hoover's FBI was grotesquely overreaching its purpose, and that it was developing files on virtually everybody who had a position of influence so that they could control them. It wouldn't surprise me in the least if Putin is in this position in Russia, where he has established a government based upon oligarchic principles, and that he either goes along with the mechanism that exists in Russia, or he too will become victim of them. But it is no different than what we witness in the United States. Now, the contrast to that, of course, is that these Olympic Games, despite American journalists wanting to paint Russia as a horrible place because they view that it is homophobic when it's not, the citizens of Russia have been extraordinarily good sports, including Putin, visiting with international teams, giving hugs to winners of events, even if when they're not Russian. It is a beautiful event. And on Saturday morning, very early, the Russians lost a very difficult hockey game on a call that was highly suspect. Yet they didn't complain. You know, it appears that we may have been unsportsmanlike in the way that a goal was disallowed because of the dislodging of a net by the American goalie. Whether it was intentional or unintentional is subject to question, but the Russians, perfect sports about it. And so you look at all of that and you say, wait a minute. No. Have these people been grotesquely, in their country, grotesquely, including their leaders, miscategorized? In this light, that's why I watched the Olympics. There was one part of it that I was repulsed by, and it's NBC's the coverage of ice dancing events. I happened to pay no attention to ice skating, with exception of the Olympics, but the music and the dance and the pageantry and all. At the Olympics, it's garners my not undivided attention, but at least my attention. I think ice dancing is a beautiful spectacle, as is pair skating and women ice skating, something else that I find beautiful. I even look at the men's performances as extraordinarily athletic. Well, America chose a commentating team that was comprised of a woman and a homosexual man. Well, the fact that the man's homosexual, no problem. You know, it's probably there's a cliche, and I don't know, I shouldn't use probably, but the cliche, you know, is that in ice skating, a significant number of the men might lean towards homosexuality, and he was a former competitor. I have no issue with the fact he's homosexual. I have a problem that he's a transvestite, and that he is demonstrating that he is a transvestite by wearing dresses, tiaras, necklaces, not the kind of necklace that, you know, is puka beads that guys wore back in the fraternity days. No, these are women's necklaces, women's tiaras, women's jewelry, women's makeup, and women's dresses while he is doing his commentary on the Olympics. You know, I have a problem with sports featuring a transvestite. Now, I don't much care if he is a transvestite, Johnny Weir, in his private life. You know, in his private life, if Johnny Weir wants to dress up like a girl, if Johnny Weir wants to go to bars that favor transvestites, If he wants to hang around other transvestites, that's okay. I've got no problem with that either. But in an international sporting event like the Olympics, to have to endure the visual imagery of a man dressed as a woman, that's troubling to me. I happen to agree with Putin's stand relative to homosexuality. His stand is articulated often in his speeches. He doesn't care if someone is homosexual or not. I don't either. What I don't like is when sexual preference becomes a cause célèbre, when it is thrown in my face, when that which is abnormal is presented as not only normal, but superior. And that's what we are witnessing in many countries around the world. All the Russian law says is you can be a homosexual if you wish to. Your private sexual behavior and orientation is your business. But don't make it our business. Don't flaunt it in our face. Don't promote it, particularly around children. I think their position is a great deal more sane, more reasonable, more rational, a great deal more moral than is our own. This story from CNN, it broke the end of last week. Senator Rand Paul said Wednesday that he is suing President Barack Obama, as well as top security officials, over the government's sweeping electronic surveillance program that was made public by the intelligence leaker Edward Snowden. The Kentucky Republican and conservative group Freedom Works are filing a class action challenge against the government's phone metadata collection effort, which stores the numbers and the call times of phone calls made by every American. Now, Senator Paul Rand acknowledged that the generally large composition of the class that is bringing the suit, which would be the American people, could complicate the case. But he says, we didn't define the class. This class was defined by the arrogance of the U.S. government. And because it has decided that the Fourth Amendment actually allows a warrant to be written for everybody's phone records. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering the suit that a senator, Rand Paul, brought against the President of the United States. But it also names my single least favorite American, Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, in addition to the outgoing Director Keith Alexander. It's actually General Keith Alexander, and FBI Director James Comey in the suit. He said, we did this out of respect for the U.S. Constitution and out of the belief that these decisions cannot be made in secret by a secret court, but that they need to be made in open by the Supreme Court, end quote. Now, the problem, of course, of that is that the Supreme Court does not rule on the Constitution. They've stopped doing that a long time ago. The Supreme Court rules almost entirely based upon political persuasion. Those who are liberal rule in favor of a liberal use of government and of societal engineering, and those who are conservative try to maintain the status quo. But for there to be a single gun law, for example, in the United States, means that the U.S. Constitution is disregarded. For there to be affirmative action in the United States and to have that be so pervasive across the country, there has to be a ignorance of the U.S. Constitution. For Obama's Health Care Act, the Affordable Care Act, to become a law, there has to be a complete and wholesale disregard for the U.S. Constitution, because it mandates the kind of health care that every American can have and penalizes Americans who choose not to have health care insurance. And the U.S. Constitution says that there's only a very set and specific group of things that the U.S. government has authority over, and all the rest of that either belong to the states or to the people. And I will guarantee you that you won't find redistribution of wealth or health care as part of those things that the U.S. government has authority to mandate. So this article continues to read, according to the lawsuits, the plaintiffs and class members want a declaration that bulk media metadata collection is unconstitutional. It's obviously unconstitutional, black and white. Everybody that's got half a brain recognizes that the NSA is violating the U.S. Constitution. They want an end to it. They want an order to purge storage data that's related to the plaintiffs and class members. This quote, Americans do not like to think that their government is some kind of an Orwellian Leviathan, engaging in surveillance tactics that we only expect to see in oppressive autocracies, Paul wrote in his opinion piece for CNN. That such surveillance could be going on in what is ostensibly the freest nation in the world is a chilling thought indeed, end quote. Well, I'm going to tell you, America's not the freest nation in the world. It's not even among the freest nations in the world. And that every time that a survey is done of freest nations, America is not at the top of that list. It once may have been true. It has not been true for a very long time. And the fact that the American government is Orwellian should not be a surprise to anyone. We have become a police state. We have become what we once despised. This is now a militant, military police state. The firebrand Republican Party, who's the firebrand in the Republican Party, whose brand of conservatism embraces libertarian ideas, Paul is an ardent critic of U.S. surveillance program, which he says infringe on basic civil liberties under the Constitution. That, by the way, is an ad hominem attack to try to paint Paul as this article's journalist would say, well, boy, they are wacko, firebrand, Republican, hell and brimstone, conservatism. Oh, boy, those wacko libertarian ideas. That would explain why he's a critic of these programs. And of course, a liberal would say, the bigger the government, the better. The more control the government has, the better. I would say that this example is that 300 million people are being affected really illustrates the consequence of this, he said. Snowden's links to the media about last year about the NSA collection of telephone and mail data outraged libertarians in particular. Also, privacy advocates and many members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. Actually, it was very few members of Congress. And it did influence negatively all libertarians and anyone that is a advocate of freedom and of privacy. As a matter of fact, if the revelation that your government is spying on you didn't bother you, well, I pity you. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering This. Because I am an American, I'm embarrassed to tell you that Americans nationwide are split on the issue of the NSA. A most recent survey, one conducted just in the last 4 weeks, indicated that 48% of registered voters support the metadata program, compared to 47% who oppose the data collection. That means 40% of Americans are opposed to the U.S. Constitution. Now, in America, I don't put the Constitution up there like so many do, as if it were a divine document. I've got issues with the U.S. Constitution. But the fact of the matter is, without the U.S. Constitution, there is no government. There's no rule of law. There's no sense of fair play. There's no basis for the country. And if you are willing to ignore the U.S. Constitution because you have been beguiled into believing that the government, when it ignores the Constitution, when it does things that are opposed to the U.S. Constitution, actually makes you safer, then you're really too dumb to be expressing an opinion. It's just all there is to it. I know that might sound harsh, but that's reality for the 48% of you. You know, if you believe that by violating the UN's constitution, which is the basis for the republic, that you are actually safer than you would be if the U.S. government honored the document that they have sworn to uphold, then, you know, I can see why so many Americans are religious. They're just not able to process information in a rational way. 5% of Americans said, we're just not sure and we have no opinion. At least they're telling the truth. Quote, as we've said previously, we believe the program as it exists is lawful. Caitlin Hyden, a spokesperson for the National Security Council, said Wednesday in a statement to CNN, indeed, it has been found to be lawful by multiple courts. Actually, it's only been found to be lawful by one court. And that's the court that exists for the express purpose to give it the illusion of legitimacy. And it receives oversight from all three branches of government, including the Congress. Actually, there is no oversight of the program. They perjure themselves, the leaders of the program, like James Clapper, in presenting information to Congress, and they gripe about hating the idea that they have to even report to Congress. In fact, Clapper's last report says, you know, I'm disgusted that I have to be here, you know, sharing in open Congress these issues. So they don't. They misrepresent the facts. They don't provide information that is necessary for oversight, and there really is no judicial oversight at all, because the court that has been created is a court that exists only for the purpose of the NSA. And so he lied, of course, but that's what the goons that run these surveillance programs as part of the United States do. They're extraordinarily destructive. They have been for a very long time. It doesn't matter if they're employers, the NSA, the CIA, or the FBI. They are counterproductive. They're destructive of freedoms. They are grotesquely immoral. They have not done anything to protect Americans. And as a matter of fact, they are counterproductive. It's very much like the American military. America would be freer and safer without both. On CNN's Legal View with Ashley Banfield, Tubun said that you have to prove that you were injured, and the government is likely to argue that neither Paul nor any of his plaintiffs can prove that this was the case or even that their calls were monitored. Well, the fact is that every call is monitored. And so the revelation by the documents that come directly out of the NSA says that every call was monitored. And if you don't think that your rights are being infringed, that you have been injured when your private conversations are being recorded, when they're being monitored, then you don't have any kind of an understanding of what freedom is supposed to be all about. Tobin did, however, state that the underlying issue as to whether the program is constitutional is a real concern. Because it's not. I had promised to share a story about the FBI that just kept on getting pushed down the list as new stories emerged each day. I want to correct that error and want to share a story that the Washington Post printed regarding what they call, and this is the headline, Remembering an Earlier Time When a Theft Unmasked Government Surveillance. Now, we know about what Snowden has done on our behalf, which is to reveal that our government is has run amok, that they're out of control, and that they've created a Gestapo-like police surveillance state that is in direct opposition to the U.S. Constitution. It's not the first time. On March 24th, 1971, now this is the author of this article, writing in the first person for the Washington Post, said, I became the first reporter to inform readers that the FBI wanted the American people to think there was an FBI agent behind every mailbox. That rather alarming alert came from the stolen FBI files I found in my own mailbox at the Washington Post when I arrived at work the previous morning. It was the return address on the big tan envelope that prompted me to open it first. Liberty Publications Media, PA. I had worked at the Evening Bulletin in Pennsylvania before coming to the Washington Post in January of 1970, so I knew of Media, a small town southwest of Philadelphia. The letter inside the envelope informed me that on the night of March 8th, 1971, my anonymous correspondents, they called themselves the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI, had broken into the Media FBI office and stolen every file. They did so, I learned later, in the dark, as the sounds of the first Muhammad Ali Joe Frazier boxing match filled the streets. Quote, evidence you will find, the letter said, copies of certain files from Media Pennsylvania office of the FBI, which were removed by our commission for public scrutiny. We are making these copies available to you and to several other persons in public life because we feel that you have shown concern and courage as regards to issues which are in part documented in the enclosed materials, end quote. Very much like what Snowden did. He copied files that showed that the U.S. government had grossly not only violated the U.S. Constitution, but was now grotesquely spying on Americans. And that it was capturing their phone calls and their keystrokes on the computer. And that knowing that this was wrong and that you cannot have a free society under such surveillance, he released what he found, not all of it, but selected files, to the media, saying, you know, here it is. You decide if this is in the public interest to know. This story continues. I wasn't aware of having shown any courage, but I was, to put it mildly, eager to read those files. 14, as it turned out, of the 1,000 files that they had taken. For 43 years, the people who sent those files to me remained unknown to the general public. This week, five of the Media FBI burglars, a group that pulled off an act that led to the congressional investigations of all intelligence agencies, congressional oversight, and significant reforms in the FBI, are coming forward at this time. In a book I have written in 1971, a documentary film by Joanna Hamilton, the burglars tell their story. The ultimate result of a chance encounter I had at a dinner party in 1989 with acquaintances in Philadelphia who told me that they were involved in the media burglary. There were eight of them. Seven have now explained why and how they broke into the FBI office, with five of them revealing their names. William Davidson, then a physics professor at Haverford College and the leader of the group, who died in November. James Raines, then and until recently a religion professor at Temple University. Bonnie Raines, a daycare center director, and since the director of organizations that advocate for children. Keith Forsythe, then a cab driver, and now an electrical engineer. Bob Williamson, then a social worker, and now a life and business coach at in Albuquerque. The other surviving burglars who came forward to live in Philadelphia. When I first looked at the contents of the envelope from Liberty Publications, I had no idea who might have done such a thing. The first file I read grabbed my attention. In it, FBI agents were encouraged to increase interviews, interrogations, inquisitions with dissenters for plenty of reasons, chief of which are that it will enhance the paranoia endemic in these circles and will further serve to get the point across there is an FBI agent behind every mailbox. Folks, that's a quote. The FBI, according to the FBI's own internal documents, encouraged these interrogations, these inquisitions, with anyone who dissented, anyone who did what we're doing here on this program, saying that your government has run amok, that the very people that are being praised for protecting you are making you vastly more vulnerable, that the people who are sworn to uphold the Constitution are violating it. And this is the quote from those documents, the FBI's own documents. For plenty of reasons, chief of which is that it will enhance the paranoia endemic in these circles and will further serve to get the point across that there's an FBI agent behind every mailbox. Inappropriately, without due process, snooping, violating your personal freedom, your liberty. Spying on you without a court order. It was wrong then. It is wrong now. And we've just begun to peel back the layers on this onion. Stay with us when we return after the commercial break. The journalist working for the Washington Post wrote, if the FBI had paranoia as its goal, and there's no if here, that's what the internal document from the FBI, written by senior officers at the FBI, stated that paranoia was a goal of its intelligence operations. Now, that was significant news. Every document told a story about FBI power that was unknown to anyone outside the FBI. One signed by FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover on November 4th, 1970, had two subject headings: black student groups on college campuses and racial matters. It was the first of numerous FBI files I would receive from the anonymous burglars over the next 2 months that revealed Hoover's programs targeting African Americans. The files revealed that African American citizens were being watched by the FBI and their informers everywhere they went, whether it was to the corner store, classrooms, churches, bookstores, libraries, bars, or restaurants. Every FBI agent was required to hire at least one informer to report to him regularly on the activities of black people. In the district, this would be the District of Columbia, Washington, every agent was required to hire six informers for that specific purpose. By the way, that's how the CIA worked today. We simply hire informers. No concern as to whether those informers are honorable individuals, whether the money is going to help U.S. intelligence or help those who are opposed to the United States. Well, that is just the nature of the beast. It is when you're bribing people to do things that are despicable, you ought not expect good, high-quality results. But that's how the FBI and CIA have operated for years. In the districts, as I said, they were required to hire six informers for that purpose. On one college campus in Philadelphia, Swarthmore College, every black student was under surveillance and there was a file being kept on them. In these documents, Hoover conveyed a sense of urgency about the need to monitor black students, intimidate, inquire immediately. I cannot overemphasize the importance of these expeditious, thorough, and discreet handling in these cases. Increased campus disorders involving black students pose a definite threat to the nation's stability and security. So, African Americans who are protesting racial discrimination, which was a very real problem in America. I mean, if you go back into the Deep South in America, in the 1950s, even into the early 1960s, based upon the color of one's skin, you could or could not go to eat at a restaurant. You could or could not sit on a bus. You could or could not use the restroom. I mean, it was despicable. It was heinous. It was unconstitutional. And yet the director of the FBI said that it was a duty of FBI agents to hold these inquiries and to conduct investigations of every African American who was on the side of doing the right thing, who was opposed to that which was unconstitutional. And he said that the nation's stability and security were at stake. That's the same thing that the defenders of the NSA are saying. Oh, the nation's stability, its security are at stake. You ought to let us do what's wrong for your own safety. That was the position of J. Edgar Hoover. You ought to let us do what is wrong to those who are right for your own good. It's disgusting. It's exactly like the NSA. Nothing has changed. When I finished reading the files I received that day in March, I knew I held in my hands either a cruel hoax or information the American people desperately needed to know about the most powerful law enforcement agency and the FBI director it had long adored. Within an hour, the FBI confirmed that the files were indeed copies of those stolen from the media office. It was not a hoax. The American FBI was as villainous as these documents claimed. Why is it that the FBI still exists? There's more to this story. And after the news and commercial breaks, we will continue with it. It is something we all need to hear, to deal with, to judge.